Hi, everyone. Thanks very much for coming to hear my presentation. I'm going to do things differently today, and I hope that it is satisfying because, you know, I am in the middle of sort of a transitionary period, or I guess I'm always in a period of sort of transition, but in particular, I'm, you know, trying to branch my work into new directions. And all of this new work and research is very much still in formation, and I'm grappling with new ideas and new places. And I, so I feel very much in this in-between state. And so I started to prepare talk today that's, you know, a variation on the kind of talks that I have often given over the last year. And I started to feel really dissatisfied and bored with myself. And so that's not a good place to be. And so I thought, okay, let me try to do something different. So I have written some I've gotten some writing commissions this year, and I have some new pieces of writing that I thought were very thematically on point with the seminar series, and I thought maybe I can share some of that writing with you all. It's only been read so far by the editors of the journal that it's being published in, and by my ex-partner. And so, you know, this is a special treat, and I would love to hear how it lands, and is also feels a bit kind of risky to me, in the sense of, you know, I'm very comfortable with speaking about my work in a certain kind of way, and this is going to be a bit different. So I'll share that writing with you, but first I'm going to do a screening of the film from the installation "What Remains at the Ends of the Earth," then the reading will be accompanied with some visuals.
Some histories are cast in the light of a falling star that extinguishes the dinosaurs and gives rise to the dawn of capitalism. Strange beasts that develop tools to segregate existence from itself and put us to work against our own interests. They drill 10,000 feet and 65 million years deep into subterranean oceans, black with soil and oil, life and death. Powers too great for the tool bearers to wield. They raise colonies of primordial bacteria from their slumber. Put them to work, powering a trillion electric stars that are viewable from space, to block the light of the old gas gods. That was when we were lost. Not so long ago, when Earth was sacred, we looked to the stars to show us the way. These days we honor constellations of pipelines and wells drawn by fossil fuel corporations, along guidelines laid by colonial joint stock companies. Haphazard icons unhinged from symbolic logic outline paths to profit and progress that we follow the ends of the earth. Some say that to know the truth we must ascend, to view the earth through the blue eyes of the state. No. To ascend is simply to bear witness to the lie. to the catastrophe. The clouds break. My heart. Below me stretches the whip-lashed skin of my homeland, flayed and fragmented by 10,000 miles of canals, 50,000 miles of pipeline, and 90,000 wells carved into the flesh of the earth. Capitalists are voracious land eaters. Their infrastructure devours the black earth, killing the plants that hold sediment together as land, receding the gradient buffer between our ecological community and the storms at sea, displacing place from itself. Their power draws on ecological fission. Humanity is segregated from our wider ecological bodies. Black bodies are segregated from the body of humanity. The end product of segregation is the world's disintegration. Our ecological body becomes a diaspora. The unnatural disaster of colonialism unfurls still today, emitting fractal catastrophes that spawn like sine waves. Coastal erosion, cancer, climate change. What remains? Refineries, tank farms, and walls. Walls. Walls striving vainly to shore our fragments against our ruin. To accumulate the world, the capitalists must arrest our body's movement, dissect it into private property, and put it to work. They call this place the working coast, but once it was called plantation country. The black earth has been worked as hard as its people. Under threat of the whip and the noose, and the cement cell block. Black hands levied the river's banks, segregating them from their land. They drained its fluid floodplains, hardening them into an industrial zone. And still, the black hands of our ancestors made life amid fields of death. They offered humble rituals of repair, planting magnolia and willow trees to hold their dead in a more than human embrace. Groves of trees offer their roots, garnished in mycelial threads, to resuscitate soil asphyxiated by monocrop plantations. In the face of industrial dispossession, roots anchor black communities to their land. Against the tide of coastal erosion, roots hold sediment together as land. migratory birds land and nest, offering their guano and seeding the next generations of more than human resistance. To know the truth, we must descend and return to the river, to our source. I don't know much about gods, but I think that the river is a strong brown god, and we are its children. The muddy Mississippi gave birth to our land through 7,000 years of alluvial leaps, throwing out skirts of water as she danced in harmony with the outer continental shelf and the muskrat and the oyster. The oyster eaters called this place Bubancha, land of many tongues. Our ecology is a messy community of bodies, made of bodies, of bodies, bodies of land, bodies of water, bodies of people flow and become entangled, become solid through the bonds that hold each to the other. See like a state. I see like an ancestor with the future in my belly. I see like a bird with a map of home behind my eyes. According to the folk tales of my enslaved ancestors, birds are messengers from the spirit world, and black humans can fly. I offer this message to you. What remains at the ends of the earth is ecological resistance. Not just humans, but whole ecosystems aspiring to open portals to new horizons. Ashe.
It's nice to be able to see my own work because I feel like I never watch it. Yeah, I made this film as a part of an installation commissioned by the curator and artist and activist Kara Atiyah for the 12th Berlin Biennale last year. And as I was sharing with the students earlier today, this was the first time that I had been asked or had the opportunity to present this body of work around Louisiana in a specifically art exhibition context. My work is, has been for years activist work first, has been kind of, has had very clear sort of political educational objectives. And it was a real relief, actually, to get asked to create something for an art context, because I feel that, I had accumulated so much that I wanted to say that couldn't be communicated through the different types of mapping projects that I was working on through the forensic architecture investigation. And I needed another forum in which to express that. And I think art is an incredible way to speak at a slower pace to speak with a different tone, to speak hypothetically, poetically, and in a very personal way. And so I very much appreciate being able to oscillate between, you know, modes of speech, right? So I'm now in a position where, you know, I'm still doing work with forensic architecture. We are working on a new investigation into a recent incident at a refinery in Louisiana. And simultaneously, I am getting more opportunities to create more poetic work, opportunities to write. And so that's what I will continue to share with you today. So I'm going to hope that this works. And I'll be reading from a text that's called "And Still the Brightness Shines Through the Holes in the Earth." And I look forward to hearing your responses. "The air is different here," my partner, Mathieu, remarks upon exiting the airport. Mathieu's first visit to New Orleans is like a first step onto the moon. "Yes, there's a heaviness to the air. It's a result of the humidity," I answer easily. "Yes," he says, "but also something else. Oh, it's the emissions from the petrochemical plants that's round the city," I offer readily. "Their noxious odor is more pervasive than ever. It's even hanging over the wealthy Garden District neighborhood, and the city's most privileged residents are outraged. My hypersensitive eyes and skin start burning not long after we leave the airport." "Yes, there's that," he counters. "But there's something else still, something otherwise, something like dancing." "Oh, you mean the brightness." "I was raised in New Orleans, Louisiana. Spent my childhood there until 2005 when Hurricane Katrina left 80% of the city underwater, displacing my family along with 100,000 other Black residents. The city's rebirth has taken the form of gentrified replacement. These days, I oscillate between states of wanderlust and nostalgia, unsure of the prospect of homecoming to a place promised a future of industrial disaster and climate displacement. Desiring security, I attempt to settle in London. Unable to stay away, I settle my gaze upon Louisiana's image like a distant lover. I dedicate my life to mapping the forces that displaced her people into a diaspora and to sharing the story of her destruction with the world. Through the newly remote perspective of satellite imagery on my laptop, I learn to sense Louisiana's topography as an archipelagic extension of my own body, to read the oil wells and canals in our wetlands as open wounds in our ecological skin. But how can I convey a sense of the spirit that continues to draw me to her body? I was surprised while reading Jeff Vandermeer's Southern Reach trilogy a few years ago to stumble upon the perfect language to describe that ineffable centripetal force. Vandermeer's books, situated in an indeterminate wetland geography called the Southern Reach, begin untold years after a succession of military and scientific expeditions have tested the impotence of guns and theories against an unknowable, more than human force known only as the brightness. Touched by the brightness, species mutate. Humans become animals, becoming plants, becoming frightening specimens of an uncanny in-between. One by one, missions fail and succumb. The brightness spreads ferality through the military's containment zone, from coastal salt marsh through brackish swamp and right up to the bottomland hardwood border beyond which the military's base squats. But if the borders erected between species couldn't hold up, then certainly the military's self-sequestration wouldn't stand a chance. Acceptance, aptly the title of the third book in the trilogy, of Earth's ability to wrest control of the levers of change, was the inevitable conclusion from the first. And so I began to imagine that something else, something between Louisiana's heat and humidity, poltergeists and pollution, as the brightness that pervades the fictional swamplands of Vandermeer's Southern Reach.
Oops.
Swamps everywhere are enmeshed in cycles of becoming otherwise. Life becomes death, and death begets life. Soil and water ebb and flow, and everything mixes in the murk. We humans only glimpse the complexity of deltaic systems through the points, through our personal points of intersection, the moments where our bodies meet the earth. But if we stretch out our consciousness, we can sense much further than the reach of our fingers. There's a reason why... Oops, oh no. Sorry. It's just gonna turn the volume down a tiny bit. There's a reason why marshlands born of riverine deltas from Egypt to Iraq to Nigeria to Louisiana are cradles of biodiversity and human civilizations. Deltaic ecosystems are great attractors, drawing human and non-human beings into their gravitational fields. There's a magic in those swamplands, magic and horror. As wetlands attracted indigenous civilizations, so too did they attract those civilizations' destroyers, colonizers, slave traders, sport hunters, and oil corporations. Churning vortexes of life and death settle, layer, and accumulate as vast subterranean fields of oil and gas. We might think of them as the final resting places for millennia of life. I recognize Louisiana's reflection in the shifting landscape of the Southern Reach, because in Louisiana, an external power has disrupted her ancient systems and imposed its own, tipping the scale toward her and our becoming otherwise. That power is colonialism. Its system is extractivism. Extractivism deploys the force of segregation to divide existence into alienable, fungible, divisible, accumulable fragments. Extractivism declares indigenous lands empty, prefiguring their genocidal dispossession. It alienates human beings from our ecological bodies, and racialize Black bodies beyond the borders of humanity. It corsets the Mississippi River with levees, segregating river from land and impeding land generation cycles of floods and alluvial deposition. It exiles Black, Brown, and Indigenous communities to the most precarious geographies and disperses us to the eroding edges of the earth. Untold millions of holes have been drilled 10,000 feet deep into the body of earth. Millions of barrels of oil gush forth into our waters, 5 months here and 19 years there. Corporations deploy chemical dispersants to sink slicks out of sight and mind. Their emissions lurk beyond the threshold of visibility, lingering among clouds, settling in cells. Air and water are toxified, mutating the building blocks of life. Thousands of miles of wetlands erode around the world. Ecologies unravel. The air shifts, the currents fail. Species and places, once familiar, become strange. I recognize Louisiana's reflection in all these places because somehow, in spite of it all, or perhaps because of it, a brightness shines through the holes drilled through the fabric of existence. Our ancient non-human ancestors, says Maladoma Patrice Somme, a shaman from the Dagara community of Burkina Faso, dwell beneath the surface of the earth, forming a vast pool of energy. Maladoma was a dear friend of my mother's. I had hoped to study under him, to learn his perspectives on ecological philosophy, but he passed unexpectedly in 2021. So these days I imagine us in dialogue across the Kalunga line, across the ocean of death and rebirth, through lines of text in his books. Oh, is theirs the energy that we pump and burn? I ask Maladoma. Is climate change the exhalation of the immeasurable size of our primordial kin at the intransigence of racial capitalism in its destruction of the planet? Is theirs an exhaustion too grave to be tabulated in parts per million? As Louisiana disintegrates, my body swells with grief. My face swells with unshed tears. My neck, my shoulders, my back, my arms, my chest, my belly twist and warp, contort and concave, to shield my heart from the retreating embrace of the world. My muscles grow around my grief, connective tissue calcifying to bone, my skin rashes revealing an inner turmoil. I am a system out of balance. I notice how grief territorializes and mutates the body, the geography of my body, and I wonder how non-human bodies spatialize this grief. Nature is the only place that can hold the spirits that leave the cities and towns, remarks Maladoma. It is beyond thought what will happen if nature, already so endangered, is destroyed. The shipwreck of our souls under racial capitalism is externalized as landscape. As Louisiana unravels, we all unravel. It is undeniable that my move to London was a futile attempt to flee this unraveling. I wouldn't use the word exile for myself, I say to the Lebanese filmmaker at the winter barbecue in London. But I do feel as though I can't live there again, and I feel that grief in my bones. That feeling in your bones, replies Maladoma, is knowledge in the form of memory. My body remembers every moment, feels every change, holds every loss from a disaster 300 years old and still unfolding. It drives my partner mad that I can't let go of the past. Before colonists enslaved her and erased her given name, Louisiana was known as Bulbancha, meaning land of many languages in Mobilian, a unifying trade dialect of Choctaw. The vibrations of shared language wove together over two dozen nations: Atakapa, Avoyelles, Bayagula, Biloxi, Chato, Chawasha, Chittimacca, Choctaw, Homa, Coasati, Koroa, Mugalasha, Muscogee, Natchez, Natchitoches, Olalusa, Opelousa, Pascagoula, Quapaw, Kinipisa, Suchitioni, Tayensa, Tangipahoa, Tawasa, Washa. The Mobilian language speaks to the heart of Louisiana. It reminds us that she is a place of convergence, integration, and flow, in spite of it all. At a mere 7,000 years old, Louisiana's land is young. The loss of my motherland is to the earth the loss of a child. As alluvial soil, Louisiana's land has youthful energy. She wants to be revitalized and refreshed, to mingle with new sediment traveling down the Mississippi River from faraway places. Our land wants to be loose and free as our hips and our spirits. And when we really feel ourselves, we flow with our wider ecologies. And yet for these 300 years, colonialism has forced us to settle, to be stiff and still, to resist the Delta's desire to flow with change. Is this why we humans feel so stuck? Stuck in time, stuck in our ways, stuck in the abyss of racism and corruption and evasion and denial. And yet, as we witness our land and our people slipping away, our tongues are let loose. Across Louisiana in indigenous communities from Île de Jean Charles to Houma, and in Black Freetown communities from Ironton to Welcome, resistance erupts like levee breaks, flooding the earth with new energy and fresh ideas so that life can branch rhizomatically. A couple of years ago in London, I initiated and led an investigation with Forensic Architecture, a human rights research agency, into environmental racism in a Louisiana region once called Plantation Country, now known as the Petrochemical Corridor, and nicknamed Cancer Alley. Rye St. James, a grassroots activist group from the community of Welcome, asked us to develop a methodology for locating the burial grounds of historically enslaved people before new industrial complexes broke ground. To determine the most likely locations of those cemeteries, we needed to understand the spatial logics of antebellum sugarcane plantations. And so as part of our research, I guided the creation of an immersive communal model, computer model of the back of the plantation, the under-researched realm where enslaved Black folk lived, labored, and were buried. Our goal was to bring atmosphere and depth to historical maps and photographs, not to produce a one-to-one replication. All the same, I was dismayed by the impossibility of an accurate rendering of the plantation's oak trees. Louisiana's oak trees are singular. They should be heavier, thicker, more expressive, I told our computer artist. Their energy is languorous and steady, slow, yet responsive to change. You need to make them thick, like the swamp air, thick like the swamp mud, thick like rue, thick like thighs, thick like time. Their branches make a start at growing upward, but seem to abandon the effort to conform to an idealized shape. Why reach stoically to the sky when one can stretch out long, long, reaching for other oaks across the way, resting one's heavy limbs against the ground? Our trees know the length of the struggle, and they're in it for the long arc. Our trees look like they have lived through things, seen things, witnessed things, survived things. They should look like they have borne the weight of history, borne the weight of the world, borne the weight of Black bodies swinging from their thick, twisted branches for hundreds of years. I would never have dreamed of 3D modeling human beings, a self-evident hubris. But the rest of the lesson, I had to learn in the act. Whether human or non-human, a body is an expression of a life lived. No reproduction can capture the spirit of those trees. The trees here are unbelievable. Visiting New Orleans in January, Matcha stops before each tree we pass, caressing its textured bark, imagining the flowers it will bear come springtime, wondering at its name. Southern magnolia, bald cypress, crepe myrtle, weeping willow, live oak. He gathers a handful of acorns with all the earnestness of a wintering squirrel. We should take some super resilient Louisiana acorns and plant them in London. Yet my friends in Louisiana remark that our trees seem sick. Their leaves are thinning out. Their crowns can't reach their kin across the way. Is it all too much for them? Mecha and I separate. I spend February by the English seaside, alone. I fall apart and come together once again. Throughout it all, the earth is here for me. Yemaya, the spirit of the Atlantic Ocean, reminds me that England's waters are the same as the waters of the Gulf of Mexico. With her, I'm always home. So how do I show up for her? What gifts could I possibly offer in thanks for her support? In what language would she comprehend my gratitude? Maladoma tells me that for the Dogara, to utter signifies nostalgia for humanity's true home, which is in nature. Expression through poetry points to our exile from nature, expresses our innocent and imperfect yearning to embrace the ineffable wonder of earth. So I shed words like dead leaves, releasing them to become hummus, the matter of infinite return. My grief releases in wails, cries, songs, plumes of carbon dioxide. And the trees around me capture that emotional exhaust and recycle it, photosynthesize it into glucose for their own sustenance, and into oxygen for my own. I inhale great, sobbing gulps of it thirstily, gratefully, and joyfully.
My name is Sharon Levine. I'm the director and founder of Rise St. James, right here in St. James Parish. And we are here to commemorate the greatest of our enslaved ancestors. We're going to stand together.
That's right.
And we're going to fight for Mosa.
That's right.
We will not allow them to take our ancestors out of this ground and put them somewhere else. We are Rise St. James, and we're going to stand up for St. James Parish. This is our home. We're not going anywhere. For Mosa have a fight on their hands.
Across Louisiana, chants and speeches and legal arguments rise to the trees. They demand a moratorium on petrochemical development, demand accountability for centuries of racial violence, demand the recovery of our erased ancestral heritage. In 2022, a Louisiana district judge issued a legal decision that lifted up the words of Sharon Levine, founding organizer of Rise St. James, reaffirming her appeal to the sacred quality of the land, holding burial grounds of historically enslaved people on Louisiana's petrochemical plantations. But where does sacred land begin and end? Sacred land is seeded by human hands that plant the trees that hold the land together. It spreads through roots and branches, entwining and migrating with birds, insects, and fungi. It is exhaled by leaves into atmosphere. Sacred land does not end at the plantation property line where earth is dug out into industrial pits and filled with petrochemical waste. It does not end at the expanding horizon of open water as fragments of earth collapse into the sea. It does not end at the human bodies who defend their right to live on their land until the ends of the earth. We are all the ground whose vegetables we eat. We are all the trees whose air we breathe. We are all the oil we spill and the chemical dispersants we spray. We absorb and become the places we are in. We are the earth we inhabit. By the end of the Southern Reach trilogy, one is left wondering whether the brightness emanates from the uncontrollable impact of an external force, or whether it represents the adaptive response of earth to such a power. Wherever it comes from, humans absorb it, become changed by it, and life goes on. Sadia Hartman asks whether 5 long centuries of systemized racial brutality were prefigured by the first arrivals of solitary Portuguese traders to the shores of West Africa. Did the future begin to unravel from the point at which the first Portuguese flag staked the earth? The holes staked by colonial flags have spread and mutated into vast expanses of pockmarked oil fields and eroding wetlands. Wherever we thought we were going, this is where we are now. This is what we know now. We have been changed by the forces of extractivism unleashed upon the earth. And now we must guide that change, as Octavia Butler reminds us. We must transition. The brightness shines through the holes in our souls, as through the holes in the earth. And as we mourn and release what we have been, we emancipate ourselves to rejoice at what else in earth's image we might become. Ashe. Thank you.